Hello. You've reached the home of John Doe, County Commissioner and the last undecided superdelegate of 2008. If you're calling from one of the campaigns and want to pitch your candidate, please press 1. If you want to invite me to ride on a sponsor's corporate jet to an exotic location, please press 2. If you would like to finance my children's education at a fine institution of higher learning, press 3. If you can help me with that little business with the IRS, please press 4. If you are a medical professional and want to speak to me about my inability to make up my mind, please stay on the line and I'll be with you in a moment.
Calling all delegates, decision time. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, June 3rd, and we're buttoning up the campaign. Today, the last two Democratic primaries are in South Dakota and Montana. Obama could clinch the nomination by the end of the week. Senator Ted Kennedy is out of surgery. A global food summit concentrates on dirt. It's not dull. And remember Bo, the man who knew much more than diddly. That and all the news. Barack Obama says he believes uncommitted superdelegates will endorse him soon after today's two final Democratic primaries. There are 31 delegates at stake in South Dakota and Montana. Obama says he'll get 15. Meanwhile, Hillary Clinton campaign into the night in South Dakota showing no outward signs of giving up.
More people have voted for me than any other candidate in the history of presidential primaries.
Reports from inside the campaign say staffers presume this is their last week of paid work. Following a court ruling, more than 400 children taken from a polygamous sex ranch 2 months ago are being returned to their parents. The judge's order requires the parents to stay in Texas, attend parenting classes, and to allow the children to be examined as part of any abuse investigation.
Chinese police dragged angry parents away today as they protested poorly built schools that crumbled to the ground in last month's earthquake. The BBC's James Reynolds reports from Dujianyang.
A few years ago, we tried to raise money to rebuild the school, this woman says. But the school didn't agree. And now my daughter has died.
About 7,000 classrooms were destroyed in the 7.9 magnitude quake. Iran's supreme leader says no wise nation would pursue nuclear weapons, but his country, he says, will continue with its nuclear program.
According to his spokeswoman, Senator Ted Kennedy says he feels like $1 million. Duke University Medical Center's top neurosurgeon performed the operation and says Kennedy was awake during the procedure.
Downbeat economic news and reports of executive changes for some big banks rattled investors yesterday. The U.S. markets closed down. The Dow begins today at 12,503. The S&P starts at 1385. Yesterday, music legend Bo Diddley died at age 79. With us is Jack Grace, the Martini Cowboy. We're going to be celebrating Bo Diddley's life and asking this question. You hear the Bo Diddley riff there, right? Everybody's covered it. What's your favorite cover? Bo Diddley cover or any kind of cover? 877-8-MY-TAKE and MyTake at thetakeaway.org. Here's one.
Hi, it's Catherine. I'm calling from Harlem, and I love Jimi Hendrix All Along the Watchtower. Bye-bye.
That's a great cover. Jimi Hendrix All Along the Watchtower. Covers all hour on The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at KnightFoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. News within the hour. 2.5 new superdelegates for Barack Obama this morning. Missouri State Rep. Maria Chappelle Nadal is announcing her endorsement, and House Majority Whip Jim Clyburn of South Carolina announced his endorsement on the Today Show this morning. A Michigan superdelegate who gets half a vote also announced for Obama. There are 31 delegates at stake in South Dakota and Montana. And Sonia Niles and Gus Chambers, you're with us. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning.
Terrific. Thank you.
You both have a decision to make, don't you?
We do.
And you're both undecided voters, as hard as that is to believe after 153 days of campaigning. You're both undecided.
Yes.
I'm beginning to lean one way.
All right. Well, share, Gus.
Well, I've always considered this process a sort of a win-win scenario. I mean, considering, what a vast improvement it's going to be over the last 7 years, whether it was Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton, I just saw this country sort of rallying. And I guess for me, it's just a matter of, under whose sort of leadership would we rally, would the spirit of optimism and enthusiasm last the longest? And I'm just, on one hand...
You're leaning. Come on, Gus, you're leaning. Let's hear the lean.
Okay, well, I'm leaning toward Hillary.
Sonia, how about you?
I'm actually leaning toward Hillary as well.
Really?
All right, there you go.
Now, why? Now, I'm actually protecting you from my co-host. Dory Doji, my co-host here, thinks that it's insane that you haven't made up your mind yet.
No,
I'm just going to give you one chance to explain why it is you're undecided at this stage, and then she's going to have at you. All right? Go ahead. Sonia, you first.
Well, I think that in the past few months, I was probably leaning the other way toward Barack Obama because I felt like, from what I had read and heard him speak in the media, he was a very inspirational, intelligent, and articulate person. But just by virtue of her tenaciousness, Hillary has started to turn my thinking that maybe we do need someone who is more seasoned in that the loop of that D.C. machine to get things going. Because
okay.
Even though it's
that's a good argument, Sonia. Let me get the sure. Gus's argument, and then Adora has a couple of questions here. Gus, go ahead.
Well, I totally agree with Sonia. I think that, a lot of people are speculating, why doesn't she just
buddy, the question is, why are you undecided after 153 days?
I look at voting for a candidate like I do buying an automobile. I wait, I look at all the choices, I kick the tires, I open the hood, and I wait until the last possible second, and then I just go with gut instinct.
Okay, I want to characterize my question a little bit differently, which was we've been listening to many people talking about this campaign for a year, and the candidates have been out in full force for more than 4-5 months now. And I was just curious about where the line, what was it going to take in order for individuals to make up their mind? And so when we heard about you guys, that was the first thought that came into my head. But I have to say, Sonia, you make a really good argument, which is you really did make a decision or felt like you'd been close to a decision, but over time you've really bought into some of the things that Hillary Clinton has been arguing.
Well, I think people from South Dakota appreciate someone who doesn't give up, and so the more I listen to Hillary and the more she comes into my state in the past few weeks, I think she has opened herself to more scrutiny by the people of this state, and I think that is doing her a lot more good here, because people want to hear what she has to say, and you don't get a lot of that from the media soundbite.
And Gus, you make a really interesting point, which is many Democrats feel at the end of the day they have really two good choices.
That's true. I think, on one hand, you always make a list of pros and cons when you have a tough decision to make. And on one hand, you've got his candor, his enthusiasm, his sort of optimism. And on the other hand, you've got her, just her experience, her,
well, by
her
the end of the
healthcare
day,
policy, her foreign policy.
By the end of the day, it's not going to be any more of this on the one hand, on the other hand. Sonia Niles and Gus Chambers, thanks so much for joining us. Gus, last question. What are you driving?
I drive a Subaru Forester.
Okay, thank you very much. And what that means, the campaigns will have to figure out. Gus
we
Chambers and Sonia Niles, undecided voters from Montana and South Dakota. Dora, it's all
and
yours.
We're about to add to the list of the undecided Pennsylvania Congressman Jason Altmaier, and he's also a superdelegate. He's been bombarded, as we can imagine, by appeals from the candidates. And Monday, it was the Obama campaign trying to sway him. Congressman, good morning, and thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
Yesterday, who called? Was it Senator Obama by any chance? And what did that phone call sound like?
Well, yesterday's call was at the staff level. I before the Pennsylvania primary in April, I put out a statement that said I was not going to do a superdelegate endorsement until after June 3rd, after all the states had voted. I thought that was the most fair way to approach it. And both candidates have respected that, so I had not heard a lot from either of them recently. But yesterday, the Obama campaign called to check in and said, are you sure we can't get you to come out? We're probably going to end this thing tomorrow night, and we would love to have you be a part of that. And my staff said, well, no, he's going to wait until after everybody votes, so we'll talk to you later in the week. And they respected that, and that was it. There wasn't much of a hard sell because I think they know that I'm firm on where I am.
Why are you so firm in that decision, given that, for example, your state has already voted? They voted for Hillary Clinton.
Right, and my district voted 30 points for Hillary Clinton. She won 65% of the vote. So for me, it's about supporting the will of the people nationally. This is a national election, and I don't want the superdelegates to be a group of party insiders that overturns the will of the people. I think of what we would think if another country had a six-month election process where everybody voted and there was enthusiasm for one of the candidates who won, and a group of insiders came in and said, well, we understand you picked this candidate, but we know better than you, and we like this other candidate. I don't want superdelegates to perform that function, So I'm hoping it resolves itself. If it doesn't, and this goes through tonight and by the end of the week, then I'll make an endorsement. But I'm hoping that the people decide, not the superdelegates.
That sounds so altruistic for a politician, no offense intended. Are you concerned at all that, for example, New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson is quoted as saying to one superdelegate, jump on board now or it won't matter after Tuesday. Are you worried about any consequences for not stepping up?
No, certainly no personal consequences. I'm worried about the perception of our nominee having been handpicked by party insiders rather than the voters themselves. And I think that's why it's important that, for me personally, my decision is to wait until everybody has voted. We'll look at where we are at the end of the week. If Senator Clinton decides she wants to stay in this race and drag it out, then I think you're going to see a lot of the undecided superdelegates come out by the end of the week.
Congressman, we spoke with a couple of undecided voters a moment ago. You're an uncommitted superdelegate. Is it different to be undecided from being uncommitted? You know what I mean?
Oh, I think so. So
you've actually decided?
I voted in the Pennsylvania primary like everybody else.
So you've decided, you just haven't told anyone?
Well, There's two functions. One is my vote as a person, and yes, I haven't told anybody that just because of the unusual situation I find myself in as a superdelegate.
Right.
But the function of a superdelegate is a little bit different. And again, for me, it's about supporting the one that's won the national election.
Right. Now, regardless of your argument that, you know, this is about the will of the people, in fact, it's going to be decided by a bunch of superdelegates. I mean, those are elites. Those aren't the will of the people. It's superdelegates who are going to decide this.
Yes, you're right about that. And I have made my decision that I'm going to wait until after June 3rd. If it's still unresolved at that point, then I will be a part of the group that decides it. But I'm hoping that that doesn't happen.
And Congressman, those two undecided voters that we just spoke to, they both agreed that what was making the decision difficult for them was the fact that there was really two candidates before them. Would you agree with that?
I agree with what they said with regard to Senator Clinton showing just incredible tenacity and courage, and she's pushing forward, and I think there's a place for that up through the end of the process, and I admire what she's done throughout this campaign against very long odds. But again, if she just makes a decision tonight to drag this thing out longer than it should be, if the votes just aren't there, then I think you're going to see a lot of the superdelegates that haven't committed coming out all at once.
In fact, NBC has been reporting that there are several, if not more than a dozen, superdelegates who plan to come forward backing Barack Obama within 48 hours after the primaries today.
I would be surprised if there was not a lot more than that.
Pennsylvania Congressman Jason Altmaier, an uncommitted Democratic superdelegate whose district outside Pittsburgh went for Clinton in the primary there. Today we are commemorating the life
cover
of Bo Diddley.
That's right.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253. Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. A global summit to deal with the food crisis is our focus in this segment. But first, a headline. General Motors has decided, as it just announced, it's going to cease production at four factories in Ohio, Wisconsin, Canada, and Mexico. Those factories produce trucks and SUVs. Femi Okay, we'll have more about that during the news segment. Also, Jack, everybody covers Bo Diddley. He died yesterday at age 79. The Bo Diddley riff is iconic in every way. We're asking you, what is your favorite cover? For whatever reason, whatever artist, can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE, like this person did.
Hi, I'm Debbie Rose calling from New York, and my favorite cover is Jeffrey Gaines, who covers In Your Eyes, Peter Gabriel's original.
All right, so we're
in
talking
your eyes.
Right in your eyes, a great cover. The UN Secretary General says food production must rise by 50%. It's what they're talking about at the food summit in Rome. Joining us is the BBC's Christian Fraser. Christian, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
And also with me here is Pedro Sanchez, here in the studio as Director of Tropical Agriculture at the Earth Institute at Columbia University. He's also co-chair of the Hunger Task Force of the UN Millennium Project. Christian, let's begin. What's the big issue at the summit today? It seems like biofuels and subsidies are top on the agenda at this point.
Yes, I think the key point that Ban Ki-moon set out today is that by 2050, the world population will have grown by another 3 billion people. And the challenge of producing enough food to support that size of population, says Mr. Ban, begins today. And he says for too long, the industrialized nations have concentrated on their own agricultural industries at the expense of the developing world. That has to change, he says. This beggar thy neighbor attitude can't continue if we're going to find workable solutions in the long term for this food crisis that we've seen over the past year.
And the production that they're calling for, the production increases they're calling for, are really not in the developed world agricultural acreages. It's in the developing world where small acreages and fertilizer strategies have really not been maximized in the same way it's been in Europe and North America.
That's right. Part of the problem for that is the dumping of cheap food on poorer countries. African governments have thought it's not useful to invest their money in agriculture because food was so cheap to import. And there has been chronic underinvestment over the past 20 years. The experts at this conference believe the yields in these poorer countries can be increased fourfold with the right sort of help. That means providing the machinery and the fertilizers at a cheaper cost, better conservation of water supplies. It means warehouses to protect food and better roads for farmers. You know, at least a third of the crops in an average season in Africa are lost after the harvest. So it means rethinking many of the strategies that there are in agriculture in the developing world. Things like GM. We talk a lot about GM food. The trouble with GM at the moment...
You mean genetically modified food.
Genetically modified
right,
food.
Right.
The problem with that at the moment is that a lot of the research is largely devoted to developing crops for richer countries like the United States. So it's a very complex issue with many different solutions, which Mr. Ban says need to be better funded and better coordinated.
Christian, I understand that the Zimbabwe president, Robert Mugabe, is attending the conference and caused a bit of a ruckus, A, because many did not expect him to be there, and two, because of the ongoing absolute controversy of the elections that took place there more than a month ago.
That's right, yes. He has been keeping a rather low profile in the run-up to this summit, although he was filmed yesterday emerging from the five-star Ambasciatore Hotel here in Rome, which, of course, they're painfully aware of how that will be seen. But he has arrived at the conference. He's due to speak this afternoon. In 2005, he used that opportunity at a summit similar to this one to attack the likes of President Bush and the then British Prime Minister Tony Blair. He actually compared them to Adolf Hitler and then told the donors who'd gathered at the conference they should stop foisting wasting food on the Zimbabwean people.
Well, if there's anybody that needs help with agricultural production, it's certainly Robert Mugabe. Christian Fraser, thank you very much. Reporting from Rome at the Hunger Task Force, or the Hunger Summit that's taking place under the auspices of the UN. Pedro, when they talk about production increases in the developed world, they're talking about making the dirt better, the soil better in the developed world, aren't they?
Yes, absolutely. That has been the main limiting factor in Africa. The fertility of the soils has run out because farmers have taken too many nutrients out without bringing them back. Now we're finding, in our work in 80 millennium villages scattered around 10 countries in sub-Saharan Africa and all hunger hotspots, over 400,000 people involved, that the basic food crop yields can be tripled at the village scale.
Tripled?
Tripled. Tripled.
That's way more than 50%, which is what Ban Ki-moon is talking
right,
about.
Right, that's 300%. And it can be tripled at the village scale with the proper applications of fertilizers, improve varieties, not necessarily GMOs, but improve hybrids and varieties.
Genetically modified
organisms.
Right.
And that has been consistent now for 2 or 3 years.
Are we talking about making some of the same mistakes, though, that have been made in the developed world by overuse of fertilizers to over-increase the productive quality of the soil?
It could happen. However, tropical soils are a lot more resilient because they have, and being very technical here, a specific way in which they can capture nitrogen in the subsoil before it goes into the water that temperate region soils don't have. But nevertheless, the situation in Africa, not all the rest of the developing countries, but in Africa, is one of nutrient depletion. And now it has to switch drastically to nutrient enhancement.
Do you see that changing anytime soon?
Yes. Yes, it's already changed. In one country, it has changed dramatically. In Malawi, the government of Malawi in 2005 was desperate because it was importing about 40% of its food. About a third of their people were in need for food aid. They applied subsidies, 75% subsidies, to two bags of fertilizer and a few kilos of hybrid maize seed. And production increased the first year by 47%, other year by 50%, and the other year by 50%. And it's even exporting to Zimbabwe now.
Oh, wow. That's incredible. I have more questions for you. Pedro Sanchez is the director of tropical agriculture at the Earth Institute at Columbia University. But now we go to headlines with Femi Oke.
I've just gone 28 minutes past the hour. The long Democratic primary race may be drawing to a close. Barack Obama is now 2.5 more delegates closer to clinching the nomination, while Hillary Clinton may be weighing an exit. Senator Ted Kennedy is recovering at Duke University Medical Center after having surgery for a cancerous brain tumor. Maria Sharapova is out of the French Open. The loss could cost Sharapova her number one world ranking. Darina Safina beat her 6-7, 7-6, 6-2. And finally, the Pittsburgh Penguins have kept their Stanley Cup hopes alive. A relieved Peter Sikora scored the winning goal.
It's nice to get a winner like that to keep us alive. And, you know, we get to live another day.
They edged out the Detroit Red Wings 4-3 in triple overtime. Detroit has a 3-2 lead in the series. Game 6 is tomorrow night back in Pittsburgh.
All right, but you need to check out. General Motors has announced it's ceasing production at 4 factories in Ohio, Wisconsin, Canada, and Mexico. No word yet on the number of workers that are affected.
Exactly.
Truck and SUV plants.
The first question, right, of course, is how many people is this going to affect?
Well, Femi will have
Thanks,
the answer.
Femi.
Thanks,
Hello.
Femi.
I'll see you in 10 minutes.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, now featuring Father's Day, a short film about a woman whose father left her when she was a child, and her daughter, who now wants to meet her estranged grandfather, if he lives long enough. Available at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. Today is Tuesday, June 3rd, and Senator Ted Kennedy is recovering from 4 hours of brain surgery that took place yesterday at Duke University Medical Center. It followed his diagnosis of a cancerous tumor called a malignant glioma, which which happened 2 weeks ago, he was diagnosed with this. His surgeon described the operation as successful, calling it the first step in treatment, a step that Dr. Bernadine Healy lived through nearly 10 years ago when she, too, was diagnosed with a glioma. She's the health editor for U.S. News and World Report and the former head of the National Institutes of Health.
Good morning.
Now, you went through a very similar surgery to what Senator Kennedy, or what we understand Senator Kennedy went through. And he was actually awake, according to his surgeons, as were you. Explain why that's necessary.
Yeah, this is not uncommon when surgeons are operating on critical parts of the brain that are important to speaking, to walking, to feeling. And the senator's tumor was in the left parietal lobe, and he presumably is right-handed, which means that's the dominant lobe, and that is where the speech center is, and ability to feel in some cases and to walk. So one of the purposes of keeping the patient awake, actually the patient isn't awake during the whole procedure, they're awake while during that interval when the surgeon is resecting the tumor. So they are put to sleep, and then their anesthesia is lightened. And then they're asked to talk or to read a passage so that the surgeon will know if the patient's speech center is being touched upon with the instruments. So it's a safety precaution. Not all patients want to do it, but it is a safety precaution. And I gather that the senator woke up speaking quite fine.
And you say that your recovery was—it's stunning. It was quick that you went home after a day.
Well, I think that from brain surgery, in general, recovery is quite quick. I mean, the patient is feeling well, walking around. It's not as if they have lots of incisions in their tummy or in their chest, as one would see after abdominal or thoracic surgery. So the general recovery is it tends to be a small incision. There's really not much pain. So it's a very different kind of surgery. It's a delicate, small, very focused kind of procedure. And it just doesn't carry the same post-operative recovery time that you see with other abdominal or thoracic surgery that we typically think of when we say major surgery.
And Dr. Healy, we don't know the exact details of Senator Kennedy's condition, but you say a critical part of the surgery yesterday is to understand the genetics of the tumor. Why is that so important?
Well, I think that he had a biopsy, and usually that doesn't provide much tissue, but now that it provides enough so you can look at the tissue under the microscope and say it's a glioma. But today, we have really made major strides in understanding the genetics of gliomas, and we find that even though some of these gliomas might look the same under the microscope, they genetically can have very different characteristics. And those genetic characteristics or gene profiles can influence the drugs that might be used in chemotherapy and might say something about the longer-term prognosis. There are a lot of chemotherapy agents that are out there now that are being used, mainly experimentally, but with very good results in the glioma arena. And a lot of them are directed by certain gene signals.
Which is something that you point out about chemo and radiation is that when you went through this 10 years ago, chemo was considered, as you put it, salvage therapy. But today it's standard?
Well, usually chemo... In the olden days, 9 or 10 years ago, chemotherapy was used after there was a recurrence, and it was treated as quote-unquote salvage therapy. That's actually the word that's used in medicine, kind of a grim word,
right.
And it was sort of a last-ditch use. But over the years, it's been learned that chemotherapy and a particular kind, there's a new drug that just came on the market about 10 years ago called Temodar, does penetrate the brain. One of the concerns was that chemo couldn't get into the brain, that it gets into the brain, and has shown really very, very good effects with almost all forms of glioma. And that's why I really think we have to be cautious here. I've been so distressed by the doom and gloom talk all over the airways and in the newspapers and on people's tongues. But, you know, all of those statistics are based on yesterday's treatments, not today's and tomorrow's. So, you know, give the senator a break. He's going to fight this. He's in the fighting mode. And with these new developments, let's be optimistic. Mm-hmm. It could be years and years. And after that, who knows what's going to be available.
And optimistic, Dr. Bernadine Healy, health editor for U.S. News and World Report and former director of the National Institutes of Health. Now time for headlines with Femi Okeh. What are you working on?
Hello there. 22 minutes to the hour. You got this news just a few minutes ago. General Motors says it will cease production at four factories in Ohio, Wisconsin, Canada and Mexico. It could be up to 1,000 jobs slashed at the Canada plant. It's unclear at this moment how many workers in the US will be affected. But I have to say this news comes just as General Motors Corporation is getting ready for its annual shareholders meeting later on today. In other news, voters in Montana and South Dakota head to the polls this morning. Senator Obama has won 2.5 new superdelegate votes from South Carolina, Missouri, and half a vote from Michigan. And an initiative that would again outlaw gay marriage in California has qualified for the November ballot. And tributes are rolling in for rock musician legend Bo Diddley, who's dead at 79. Diddley summed up his own musical genius.
I'm mainly playing chords and stuff like that in rhythm. I'm a rhythm fanatic. I play the guitar as if I were playing drums.
That's Bo Diddley, dead at 79. The two longest-serving members of the Senate are waking up in hospitals this morning, separate hospitals, I might add. Senator Ted Kennedy had surgery yesterday on a cancerous brain tumour. West Virginia's Robert Byrd went in for observation after complaining he felt lethargic and sluggish. The US Senate opened debate on legislation to combat global warming, but the White House is already promising it to veto it. The bill seeks to reduce greenhouse gas emissions to below 2005 levels by the middle of the century. In international news, furious parents in China are protesting and demanding government action for schools they believe were poorly constructed. And world leaders are meeting in Rome this week to discuss rising food prices. At the same time, North Korea seems to be facing a major food crisis. I spoke earlier this morning to the BBC's John Sudworth in Seoul, South Korea.
Well, the United States says it is motivated in providing food aid purely by humanitarian concerns. It has agreed to send about 500,000 tons of food into North Korea via the United Nations World Food Programme. That decision came about after some pretty intense negotiations with the North Koreans to try to get the guarantees that when that aid is sent, it will go to the people who need it most.
And that's the United States getting together with the World Food Programme to send aid to North Korea, which right now is in such a serious situation regarding food aid that people reportedly are eating bark and grass.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
One of our listeners says this morning, doesn't George Thorogood and countless others owe their entire career to Bo Diddley? That's Bo Diddley's music you're hearing there. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Jack, let's hear that riff. That is the Bo Diddley riff. Bo Diddley, who died yesterday at age 79 down in Florida. What is that riff?
It's very simple, two chords that just sort of go back and forth, but it's something, he found something that was just in right in front of everybody, right in the air, that's a magical combination of rhythm and simple chords.
And he had a couple of stories about where he got it from. I heard on NPR last night, he said in some recorded interview it was some African tribal thing, but you have another story, actually.
If he really was just learning a country song and just went to, and couldn't get it right, and this is what the way it came out of him. And that, I believe, is the story. He modified it depending who he was talking to.
Well, but it's extraordinary, though, because it has lasted a very long time and in all kinds of music, from The Clash to George Michael.
Here's The Who doing it. Every day I get in the queue. Magic bus. Magic bus. To get on a bus that takes me to you. Too much magic bus. And you said George Michael. I think we have that one. Let's hear George Michael.
That one's not quite as exciting for me.
Well, it's the 80s, you know.
No, but what's interesting is that it's just transcended music types or genres, and it filled lots of songs that people find very significant, because immediately we've gotten all of these notes from people talking about cover songs, but also talking about their experiences with Bo Diddley. This is a great one. A woman writes, Maureen from Bronxville says, it's not a favorite song, but a story. Around 1970, I was attending a Chuck Berry Bo Diddley concert at George Washington University. There was an anti-war protest. The D.C. police used pepper gas to disperse crowds. They were in the auditorium. They didn't know what was happening. Immediately, Mr. Berry and Mr. Diddley, she said, informed the crowd that it was time for everyone to leave peacefully. But she says they remained on stage, Mr. Berry and Mr. Diddley, performing like only those two could until the very last person left the auditorium safely. They were the last to leave different times.
I'd like to see the Backstreet Boys pull that one off.
Well, I'd love to see that. Chuck Berry and Bo Diddley, that is a pretty awesome concert ticket.
That's amazing.
Back in 1970. We also have another listener who commented on Bo Diddley's influence.
Hi. As far as the Bo Diddley beat, the Smiths, How Soon Is Now, Les in Boston.
The Smiths, How Soon Is Now. There's a Bo Diddley cover right there. We've been asking people, by the way, to tell us their favorite covers. 877-8-MY-TAKE is the place to give those responses. What's your favorite cover, Jack?
Right now I'm thinking that I like Neil Young's cover of Ian Tyson's song Four Strong Winds.
That's kind of obscure. What's your favorite cover?
The only one that comes to my mind now is Mary J. Blige doing a 50 Cent song. I know that's a little...
We'll try to get that one before the end
of a left turn. But
no, that's all right.
That's one of the first songs.
That's
that
right.
Comes to mind.
How about The Doors doing "Who Do You Love"? That's actually
right.
a pretty
that's
good.
That's actually a good one. Yes, indeed.
Oh, there we go. There's Mary J. Blige doing her version of the 50 Cent song "Hate It or Love It."
Well, you know, poor Bo Diddley. His music is iconic, but he didn't necessarily benefit from it. People ripped him off. He described even Elvis ripping him off. We just have like 2 seconds. What's the lesson from Bo Diddley's life, Jack?
You're not going to be able to make money off just a drum beat. You got to get a song in there.
There we go. Thank you, Jack.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age. Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. About 30 minutes ago, we were talking about the World Food Summit that's going on in Rome, where Ban Ki-moon, the Secretary General of the United Nations, has called for a 50% increase in agricultural production around the world to meet the food crisis. And something happened, which often happens on this program. The conversation, like, went through the roof once the microphones came off. Pedro Sanchez was with us talking about increasing food production around the world. He's director of tropical agriculture at the Earth Institute at Columbia University. So we wanted to keep him with us. He was telling a fantastic story about the importance of local agriculture and how it's had an impact in Malawi, Africa. Pedro, describe how local distribution of corn in Africa has caused the nation of Malawi to bypass this entire food crisis.
Well, the governor of Malawi in 2005, was facing one of the greatest famine in its time, with about 30% of their people absolutely dependent on food aid. The newly elected president, Bingo wa Mutharika, called some of us from the Hunger Task Force and asked what we should do. And I said, sir, you may have a water drought, whether it rains or not, but you'll always have a nitrogen drought because your soils are so depleted of nitrogen. Subsidize fertilizers and subsidize the hybrid corn seed that will make that fertilizer be fully used. And he did it. The donors were opposed to it, but he went ahead and put money out of his budget and
did
it.
Why were they opposed? May I just interrupt you for 1 second? Why was there opposition?
Their opposition was because of the old doctrine, so-called the Washington Consensus, that you shall not subsidize African farmers. A little bit hypercritical because we subsidize U.S. and European and Japanese farmers at the tune of $1 billion a day and keep doing it.
We passed a $300 million farm bill just the other day.
But for some reason, there's always been this thing, you shall not subsidize a fertilizer for Africans.
Well, quickly, Pedro, what was the result in Malawi?
Well, the result is there was a 44% deficit in food production in Malawi in 2005. In 2006, there was an 18% surplus. In 2007, a 57% surplus. In 2008, the harvest just finished in April, and I was there. They estimated at about 50% extra.
There's an amazing story. Pedro Sanchez, thank you so much. Director of Tropical Agriculture at the Earth Institute at Columbia University. He's also co-chair of the Hunger Task Force of the UN Millennium Project. He was the 2002 recipient of the World Food Prize. If anyone thinks you can't increase production and have success, talk to Pedro. That was great.
And he has more successes that he will come and talk to us about,
absolutely,
things that are happening in Africa. Today, in actually 10 minutes, the polls are opening in South Dakota. It's primary day, not only in South Dakota, but also in Montana. Hillary Clinton is pushing back against reports of an imminent withdrawal from the Democratic primary race. Here she is yesterday campaigning there in South Dakota.
So here's the case that I'll be making over the coming days. We have won the popular vote, which best represents the will of the people. More people have voted for me than any other candidate in the history of presidential primaries.
Regardless of the outcome today in those two races, most political observers think Senator Barack Obama will have enough delegates soon to win the nomination. Our own political director, Andrea Bernstein, is just off the Clinton's press plane. It was a very early arrival this morning after stumping with her there in South Dakota. So you said that she was campaigning strong right up to the last second.
She was going right up to the last minute. As a matter of fact, we were all climbing on the bus ready to go, and she was out for about another half an hour, 45 minutes, shaking every last hand of every South Dakotan, signing their T-shirts, signing their books. This was not a candidate that the wheels were not falling off her candidacy, and I've certainly seen that. I was with Rudy Giuliani when his campaign was wrapping up, and nobody was coming to his rallies except for his former mayoral staff from New York and a few true loyalists.
I remember you talking about
hundreds
that.
Hundreds and hundreds of people are still coming out, and there are an awful lot of people, even in the face of at least a month of hearing it's over, it's over, it's over, who are going to come out and vote for her today in those western states.
But there are certainly signs that she may not keep going, for example.
like she's going to lose?
Well, let's see. I've been back a little over 4 hours, and already 2.5 superdelegates have endorsed Barack Obama. The half a delegate is, of course, a Michigan delegate. House Majority Whip Van Cliburn just endorsed Barack Obama today, this morning. And their campaign strategy is to try to pile up enough superdelegates by tonight so that they tonight can say, we are the nominee, even as she's preparing to give a speech in New York, and she's calling her staff in, and she's calling her big donors in. Her advanced staff has been told, you have no more work. Now they're saying, well, they have no more work because there's no more primaries, and we don't know what we're doing next. But tomorrow morning at around this time is the last public event on her schedule that we know of, and there certainly is no sign of any active campaigning going on.
And that's really telling.
It's Jim Clyburn that endorsed Van Clyburn. We don't know who Van Clyburn is.
from South Carolina.
I stand corrected.
Majority whip in the House.
From South Carolina. But that's really particularly telling, because this is a senator, this is a candidate who has had a absolutely packed schedule for basically a year straight.
Right. I mean, it's been the last two nights, just to give an example, she's arrived at her destination around 3 or 4 a.m. and then gotten up in the morning and had a whole series of events. She had a full day in South Dakota. This was no candidate carrying around her pillow and going to sleep. I mean, she was working it. But it's true, there are no appearances of it. And there appear to be some divisions in the Clinton campaign. I mean, there are people like Harold Ickes, who are known to never say die. Now, he's the advisor that everybody saw on TV at the Rules Committee meeting on Saturday, pushing for the Michigan delegates. But there are others who are saying you need to wake up and smell the coffee and realize that this thing is moving forward. Barack Obama, as a matter of fact, yesterday said that he had called her on Sunday and said, let's meet at a time and place of your choosing. There was, interestingly, when I was with Hillary Clinton yesterday, no pushback against that, saying, you know, we don't want to meet with him. The one interesting thing that I did hear Hillary Clinton say is there's this big debate going on in this restaurant in South Dakota, Tally's Restaurant in Rapid City, about whether people would support Barack Obama if he were the nominee.
And
one woman said, well, I said that I would always vote Democrat, but my friend here is not so sure. And Hillary Clinton said, well, let's take one step at a time. But that was certainly not the most definitive statement of, I'm going to be president. How could you possibly think that?
Seems like she just can't let go. I mean, this isn't about campaign. I mean, I don't know if you're talking about Hillary Clinton or Lance Armstrong here.
A lot of people can't let go. Yesterday, in this restaurant, there was a woman named Nettie Jutila, and I asked her, well, you know, well, what are you going to do? She was the one who couldn't decide who to vote for in November, and this is what she said.
I want that glass ceiling broke. I want a Margaret Thatcher named Hillary Clinton as president of the United States. That's why I think it's going to be hard for me this fall.
So there was this incredible
Margaret Thatcher?
I don't know. No. Is it so much about letting go, or is it because it was such an unprecedented race? It really was so tight from the very beginning until now,
conceivably.
So why not finish? Why not allow the voters in South Dakota and Montana to get the full-fledged experience of having candidates coming and stomping in their backyard?
Those two candidates have a mountains, you know, speaking of Montana, mountains of support. It's just that Barack Obama's mountain is a little bit higher than Hillary Clinton's. It's about 5% higher. There have been more than 4,000 delegates committed, and they're differing by about 150 now. I mean, that's a tiny number in the scheme of things. I mean,
it all goes to the convention, this close race. So, you know, does a cover come to mind? It's, here we are thinking about, you know, Bo Diddley, who died yesterday, and thinking about covers and the importance of, you know, great songs by other people, done by other people.
I want you to know, after you caught me in the last segment with not having a cover,
gave you some homework.
I think that my favorite cover of my personally is Katie Lang's cover of Roy Orbison's Crying. However, the appropriate one for the moment, Living Colors, cover of The Clash's Should I Stay or Should I Go?
That's the Hillary Clinton.
Quite appropriate.
That's very appropriate. Let's hear
it. Here we go. That's so different than...
Here we go. That is the question in South Dakota and Montana today. Andrea Bernstein, thanks for joining
us.
And that's our show for today. Jack, you want to take us out? Jack, the Martini Cowboy. Grace, in honor of Bo Diddley, who died yesterday, 79 years old.
And I got to mention NewsHound, who wrote to us and said, I love the Talking Heads cover of Al Green's Take Me to the River.
That's a great
one. I'm with
one.
You, NewsHound. That is a wonderful
one.
Cover.
That is a fabulous one. Tomorrow we're going to be talking with Patrick Henry Bass about Nollywood. That's what they call Nigeria's film industry. Did you know that? Actually, Adora is a movie star in Nigeria. Actually, yes. Look online for Patrick's DVD picks and Nollywood YouTube clips.
And we're on YouTube, iTunes, and Facebook. Join the discussion any way you like. Tell us about your long goodbyes or anything else, or your cover stories, or any of the stories you heard today at 877-8 My Take or My Take.
That's the takeaway. Jack Grace, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.